Okay, so I started on this section in the chapter of practices and perspectives, and then the subsection within this is called a natural path. Yesterday went over a discourse on magia and that sense of when the heart is still unripe, things that need to be put in place. And then the next quote I give is from Majjhima 117, which is Maha Jatarisaka Sutta, called the Great 40. I'll just read the excerpt first, but I'm going to read the whole sutta. So the excerpt, the sense of trying to illustrate the naturalness of the path. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? In want of right view, right intention comes into being. In want of right intention, right speech comes into being. In want of right speech, right action comes into being. In want of right action, right livelihood comes into being. In want of right livelihood, right effort comes into being. In want of right effort, right mindfulness comes into being. In want of right mindfulness, right concentration comes into being. In want of right concentration, right knowledge comes into being. In want of right knowledge, right deliverance comes into being. Thus, bhikkhus, the path of the disciple in higher training possesses 8 factors. The arahant possesses 10 factors. Again, this illustration of the naturalness of it, in the sense that if you put something in place, then something arises out of that. And this path has a gaining momentum of the path is one of the really, I think, important images. So often we're trying to find just the right technique, just the right piece of knowledge, the right bit of information that would sort of do it for us. But so much of it is the commitment to the whole path of training. As a sutta, the Great 40, Majjhima 117, it's a really important sutta, actually, and hence me feeling the need to read the whole thing. It helps define the factors of the Eightfold Path and their interrelationships. Feed off each other, support each other, kind of spur each other on. I mean, it is also interesting that there is an Eightfold Path, but then the result of the Eightfold Path is right knowledge, and right knowledge leading to right deliverance, and as a natural result of following the Eightfold Path. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. What, bhikkhus, is noble right concentration with its supports and its requisites? That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness. Unification of mind equipped with these 7 factors is called noble right concentration with its supports and its requisites. You know, we all want to have noble right samadhi, because it's samma samadhi. So right concentration, right meditation, right settling of mind, right samadhi. And it's just these other factors of the path that lay the foundation down for being able to bring about the arising of right concentration. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. And there is a footnote on that. This statement suggests that in order to acquire right view about the nature of reality, one must first be able to distinguish between wrong and right teachings on the nature of reality. The commentary says that this is the right view of insight, which understands wrong view as an object by penetrating its characteristics of impermanence, etc., and which understands right view by exercising the function of comprehension and by clearing away confusion. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is wrong view. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. There's that word acquisitions again, the being constituents of identity, five khandhas. And there is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? That is, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is right view, affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions. And what, bhikkhus, is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of states, enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. There's a footnote on that. This definition defines supramundane right view as the wisdom found among the aids to enlightenment as a faculty, a power, an enlightenment factor, a path factor. The definition is formulated by way of the cognitive function rather than the objective content of right view. Elsewhere, the right view of the path is defined as knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. We may understand that the conceptual comprehension of the Four Truths falls under mundane right view, while the direct penetration of the truths by realizing Nibbana with the path constitutes supramundane right view. This is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong view. Mindfully one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus these three states run and circle around right view. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. That's about a page and a half of really important teachings of the Buddha. So any questions? Right view on a mundane level, affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, that can be summarized as a view that with the foundation as an understanding and confidence or belief in the law of karma. There is action, there is result of action. That's a, how do you say, a thread that runs through all those different things. If there's what's given, what's offered, sacrifice, there's result of good and bad action. There's this world, the other world, there's mother and father, beings are reborn spontaneously. All of that, what that is characterized by is an understanding and confidence in the law of karma, that what we do actually does have results. Yeah.
Would you say it includes rebirth?
Yeah, there is this world and the other world.
So that would be rebirth.
That would be rebirth, yeah.
Right view means trusting all.
Yeah, or having a confidence in that, having a sense of that as a reality. Sometimes one might not have, because it's a view, that view gives one that sense of taking responsibility for one's actions. Because oftentimes, without that perspective, it's easy to fall into a view of nihilism, or a sense, what's the point? What's the use? Everything turns to crap anyway. You know, why bother? So you realize, no, it's really important. What we do, what we say, what we think, this all has results. Yes, it is intricate. Yes, it is sometimes hard to understand the details, but the fundamental principle is one can have confidence in. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking of a really good sutta that presents rebirth, the teaching of rebirth, as a strategy.
Right.
Is the Apanika.
Apanika Sutta, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes.
It really portrays the whole contemplation of rebirth as a strategy.
Let's see what the Majjhima 60, and it's translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as the incontrovertible teaching. The Buddha is discussing with a group of Brahmins and going over the different views and saying there is fruits of our actions. The Buddha is pretty categorical. Sometimes the Buddha is a bit kind of cagey. But he says, since there actually is causality, one who holds the view, there is no causality, has wrong view. It's not sort of, well, maybe, maybe not. No, the Buddha's very, very clear in that.
He says more or less the same thing in regards to rebirth itself.
He says the same thing with rebirth and the different realms. He basically says the same thing. He's pretty categorical. Anyway, it's a good sutta to look up. Ajahn Gajana.
Other thoughts about that? That right view is, yes, first it's, one certainly can benefit from practicing the Buddha's instructions without full belief in that. But it is what makes it the most important thing in your life.
Yeah, in terms of a natural path, it's natural for water to flow downhill, but if you put a whole lot of obstacles in the way, then it flows down slower. So in the same way, yes, it's natural. But the more willing you are to take it on fully, the quicker it is, less painful.
And also, that particular formulation is almost deliberately a bit vague, and it actually includes, there are quite a few other spiritual traditions that would pretty much completely agree with that.
One of the conditions for taking ordination, you could be ordained quite quickly. If you were a wanderer from another sect and wanted to ordain with the Buddha, you could take ordination immediately if you held a doctrine on the efficacy of action, or law, had a faith in the law of karma. Whereas if one were a kind of a devoted nihilist, then the Buddha would require a probationary period before taking one on for ordination. Is a fundamental belief in the way things are. Okay, onward. So the sutta continues. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong intention as wrong intention and right intention as right intention. This is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong intention? So intention is mitya sankapa in the Eightfold Path, the intention of sensual desire, the intention of ill will, and the intention of cruelty. This is wrong intention. And what, bhikkhus, is right intention? Intention is maybe a bit vague. Sankapa is more like a thought formation. It's not just a vague intention in the back. Sankapa, the mind has already started to roll. It's rolled with a movement. So the mind is moving towards sensual desire with wrong intention or wrong sankapa. And it's moving toward sensual desire, ill will, cruelty. And what, bhikkhus, is right intention? Right intention, I say, is twofold. There is right intention that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, and there is right intention that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. And what, bhikkhus, is right intention that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, the intention of renunciation, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of non-cruelty. This is right intention that is affected by taints, ripening in the acquisitions. This is a teaching device that the Buddha uses, well, throughout his teaching. Yeah?
I don't really understand what taints means.
Taints, it's a translation of the Pali word asava, which are kind of like underlying qualities in the mind that taint the mind, that stain the mind. A taint is like a stain. There's different translations of it. Outflows, a connotation of movement, the mind flowing out to sensual desire, flowing out to ill will, flowing out to cruelty. What are some of the other translations?
Just the opposite of influxes.
Yeah, influxes. There's debate. After 2,500 years, there's still debate of whether is it an inflow or is it an outflow. But there is a sense of flow. That's why sometimes it's translated as a canker, or Ajahn Jeff as an effluent.
Fermentation.
Fermentations. Anyway, it's not beautiful. And what, bhikkhus, is right intention that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The thinking, thought, intention, mental absorption, mental fixity, directing of mind, verbal formation in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is the right intention that is noble. Rather than defining it too tightly, it's descriptive. Oh, and I started to talk about the way that the Buddha defines what is right intention, because what is wrong is fairly clearly defined. Sensual desire, ill will, cruelty, the thoughts of all of those. Whereas what is right is the renunciation, non-ill will, non-cruelty. You can't really mandate your thoughts. You're always going to have thoughts of loving kindness. Non-ill will and non-cruelty, actually, sort of the content is one of loving kindness and compassion. But you can't mandate a right thought to always have loving kindness and compassion. But at least it's already right if one is willing to not feed the ill will and the thoughts of cruelty. And the Buddha defines that in many places, especially in the Eightfold Path, non-killing, non-stealing, rather than sort of say, oh, you've got to be... Because it's hard to measure if you say, oh yeah, you've got to have thoughts, you've got to have actions of compassion all the time, or you've got to be completely honest all the time. Good way to drive you nuts, actually. And it's a great way that Judeo-Christian belief has kept Western culture steeped in guilt and fear. Okay, next one. And it is, again, the sense of all these different factors of the Eightfold Path, the hub of it, right view, right effort, right mindfulness. All of these different factors are going to be revolving around or rising up out of right view, right effort, right mindfulness, so that right intention, right speech. Therein, because right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong speech as wrong speech and right speech as right speech. This is one's right view. And what, because is wrong speech? False speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, and gossip. This is wrong speech. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech? Right speech, I say, is twofold. There is right speech that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, and there is right speech that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, abstinence from false speech, abstinence from malicious speech, abstinence from harsh speech, abstinence from gossip. This is right speech. That's a very good example of what I was just saying, where the Buddha is using a negative way of expressing it, but it's actually a really practical way to keep in the ballpark of what really accords with Dhamma and accords with the path. If we could just sort of, you know, just having a little bit of restraint, that's really helpful. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path? The desisting from the four kinds of verbal misconduct, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from them, in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right speech that is noble, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong speech and to enter upon right speech. This is one's right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong speech. Mindfully one enters upon and abides in right speech. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus these three states run and circle around right speech. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong action as wrong action and right action as right action. This is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong action? Killing living beings, taking what is not given, and misconduct in sensual pleasures. This is wrong action. And what, bhikkhus, is right action? Right action, I say, is twofold. There is right action that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, and there is right action that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. And what, bhikkhus, is right action that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, abstaining from killing living beings, abstinence from taking what is not given, abstinence from misconduct in sensual pleasures. This is right action that is affected by taints, ripening in the acquisitions. And what, bhikkhus, is right action that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path? The desisting from the three kinds of bodily misconduct, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from them in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right action that is noble, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong action and to enter upon right action. This is one's right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong action. Mindfully one enters upon and dwells in right action. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right action, that is, right view, right effort, right mindfulness. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong livelihood as wrong livelihood, and right livelihood as right livelihood. This is one's right view. And what, bhikkhus, is wrong livelihood? Scheming, talking, hinting, belittling, pursuing gain with gain. This is wrong livelihood. There's a footnote on that. These are wrong means for bhikkhus, for samanas, to acquire their requisites. They're explained in Visuddhimagga, and then the commentary says that those mentioned in the sutta are not the only kinds of wrong livelihood, which include any mode of earning one's living that involves transgression of the precepts. There's tons and tons of them in the thinking of the Samanyapala Sutta, Digha Nikaya number 2, long, long list of all of the wrong kinds of livelihood and occupations for bhikkhus, for samanas, religious seekers. It's like a shorthand for ways of scheming, talking, hinting, belittling, pursuing gain with gain. These are different ways of trying to wheedle requisites out of the lay people. It's not very beautiful. At Anguttara 5, Sutta number 177, the Buddha mentions five kinds of wrong livelihood for lay people: dealing in arms, dealing in living beings, meat, intoxicants, and poisons. So those are the livelihoods that the Buddha points to for lay people that are wrong livelihood. And what, bhikkhus, is right livelihood? Right livelihood, I say, is twofold. There is right livelihood that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions, and there is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. And what, bhikkhus, is right livelihood that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? Here, bhikkhus, a noble disciple abandons wrong livelihood and gains his living by right livelihood. This is right livelihood that is affected by taints. And what, bhikkhus, is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The desisting from wrong livelihood, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from it in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right livelihood that is noble, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong livelihood and to enter upon right livelihood. This is one's right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong livelihood, mindfully one enters upon and dwells in right livelihood. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right livelihood. That is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. Any questions so far? Yeah.
What is meant by supramundane?
It means that it's beyond the ordinary, in the sense of one is not entangled in the habits of greed, hatred, delusion. One's not piling up unskillful karma, that whatever one does is actually increasing the amount of extremely skillful conduct and disentangling oneself from the round of rebirth and the round of suffering. That's beyond the mundane.
I was wondering if there was like a 2025 version of wrong livelihoods.
More up to date. Well, I could go on for a long time. You know, anything that's really taking advantage of people, these basic ones can be extrapolated quite easily. Like dealing in arms, especially in Britain. Walmart in America is just filled with guns and ammunition.
Dealing with arms and maybe like warfare, maybe a lot of that might be conducted.
Yeah.
On computer.
Yeah, absolutely. I know plenty of people who would consider military service. It can be a gray area because military service can be quite diverse. But certainly I know people who would definitely consider that. I mean, human trafficking, dealing in beings. Meat, of course, factory farming and the production and sale of meat, it's on an industrial scale now. It's kind of hidden to a certain degree, but it's completely out in the open. It's not beautiful karma. Intoxicants and any kind of poison, so any kind of things that are detrimental to one's health. I think 2025, going into financial services that are manipulative or are dishonest, basically, that's a huge area of industry. There's applications of technology. You know, what is it being applied to? There's lots of areas where you start sort of, you can take these fundamental principles and start extrapolating and seeing what use and what effect is actually being realized, and be able to, you know, make a decision. Because livelihood should really be, especially as a right livelihood in conjunction with the path of practice leading to the ending of suffering, should really be something that brings benefit to oneself and benefit to others on a, you know, a fundamental basis that actually enhances bright qualities of mind. Yeah.
When you say poisonous, would you classify drug dealing as that?
Oh, absolutely. That can also go into intoxicants. Yeah, you can catch it in a couple different ways.
Yeah. In the general formula of the right livelihood, it seems that it's addressed to lay people, not to bhikkhus.
In that sutta, Anguttara 5, arms, beings, meat, intoxicating poison. Yes, that's for lay people. For monks, the different ways of being able to try to gain requisites that are dishonest, manipulative, or are frivolous. And there's many, many ways. The Digha Nikaya Sutta number 2, Samanyapada, the fruits of the recluse. Then there's a long section in livelihood that the Buddha outlines the proper conduct.
Also in the Vinaya. You
know, yeah, certainly in the Vinaya.
Origin stories.
Lots in the Vinaya. Even as a monk, livelihood, something that would be considered right livelihood for a lay person would be considered wrong livelihood for a monk, like acting as a medical doctor is wrong livelihood for a bhikkhu. Well, a lot of it is because you're setting aside your spiritual vocation and then putting your attention specifically on a medical practice is helping people, but it's also sometimes what it does, you start drawing people to you that are not at all interested in spiritual practice, and you're using the vocation of a renunciant life to try to both foster one's own development of sila, samadhi, panya, but then also to encourage other people to be doing it. I've seen it because in Thailand you get many monasteries that are doing all sorts of things that aren't in the Vinaya, and certainly that's one of them. And the monasteries end up being sort of overrun by all sorts of people coming in. The atmosphere of the monastery changes from being a place of study and practice. So there's all sorts of effects that it's gone off to the side. You veered away from this opportunity for a straight path. Okay. We're not blazing through this. Which is good, actually. Okay, continuing on the sutta. So this is moving to the wrapping up of the sutta. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? In one of right view, right intention comes into being. In one of right intention, right speech comes into being. In one of right speech, right action comes into being. In one of right action, right livelihood comes into being. In one of right livelihood, right effort comes into being. In one of right effort, right mindfulness comes into being. In one of right mindfulness, right concentration comes into being. In one of right concentration, right knowledge comes into being. In one of right knowledge, right deliverance comes into being. Thus, bhikkhus, the path of the disciple in higher training possesses 8 factors. The arahant possesses 10 factors. So the person in higher training, the person who's training, is these eightfold path. For an arahant, then knowledge and deliverance have arisen, whereas for one who's still in training, then that might have not come into full fruition yet. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? In one of right view, Wrong view is abolished, and the many evil, unwholesome states that originate with wrong view as condition are also abolished, and the many wholesome states that originate with right view as condition come to fulfillment by development. In one of right intention, wrong intention is abolished, and the many evil, unwholesome states that originate with wrong intention as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right intention as condition come to fulfillment by development. In one of right speech, wrong speech is abolished. And then in one of wrong action is abolished. In one of right livelihood, wrong livelihood is abolished. In one of right effort, wrong effort is abolished. In one of right mindfulness, wrong mindfulness is abolished. In one of right concentration, wrong concentration is abolished. In one of right knowledge, wrong knowledge is abolished. In one of right deliverance, wrong deliverance is abolished. And the many evil, unwholesome states that originate with wrong deliverance as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right deliverance as condition come to fulfillment by development. Thus, bhikkhus, there are 20 factors on the side of the wholesome and 20 factors on the side of the unwholesome. So there's a footnote on that. So the 20 factors on the wholesome side are the 10 right factors and the wholesome states that originate from each. And 20 factors on the unwholesome side are the 10 wrong factors and the 10 unwholesome states that originate from each. Hence the name, the Great 40. This Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 has been set rolling and cannot be stopped by any recluse or Brahmin or God or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world. Bhikkhus, if any recluse or Brahmin thinks that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censured and rejected, then there are 10 legitimate deductions from his assertions that would provide grounds for censuring him here and now. If that worthy one censures right view, then he would honor and praise those recluses and Brahmins who are of wrong view. If that worthy one censures right intention, then he would honor and praise those recluses and Brahmins who are of wrong intention. If that worthy one censures right speech, censures right action, censures right livelihood, censures right effort, censures right mindfulness, censures right concentration, censures right knowledge, censures right deliverance, then he would honor and praise those recluses and Brahmins who are of wrong deliverance. If any recluse or Brahmin thinks that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censured and rejected, then these are 10 legitimate deductions from his assertions that would provide grounds for censuring him here and now. Bhikkhus, even those teachers from Okala, Vasa and Banya, and there's a footnote on that. Okala is a place name, and the commentary says only that these two were individuals, probably some sort of heads of some kind of order or some kind of well-known group of recluses, were individuals who lived in the country of Okala. Otherwise, their identity is unknown. So these things get snuck into the Pali Canon that are off the wall even sometimes. So. Okay, even those teachers from Okala, Vasa, and Banya, who held the doctrine of non-causality, the doctrine of non-doing, and the doctrine of nihilism, would not think that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censured and rejected. Why is that? For fear of blame, attack, and confutation. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Any questions? Yeah.
I was wondering, if you have a right view of causality, does that mean that you automatically have a right intention?
Yeah. That would be the general principle, yeah. Because that's the crux of the matter. That sense of appreciation for, there are results to all of our thoughts, our speech, our action, that has consequences. How do I work with that? How do I take responsibility for that?
One more question.
Yeah.
This is to the side of what you were talking about, but what are the benefits of observing the eight precepts as in relation to just the five? Are there extra benefits to observing the eight?
Oh yeah, there are extra bonuses.
Extra bonuses?
There's a whole different tenor, feeling to the eight precepts. Eight precepts are what are called renunciant precepts. So the five precepts are your fundamental moral precepts, your fundamental foundation of really wholesome and skillful virtue and integrity. But then with the eight precepts, you're starting to move towards the aspect of renunciation and relinquishment, because it takes a certain relinquishment to really commit to celibacy. It takes a relinquishment to just eating at one period of the day, kind of having a certain discipline around intake of one's, having a commitment to a discipline of non-distraction, not getting distracted with music and shows and paying attention to one's appearance and things like that. And the simplicity of one's dwelling place and sleeping quarters, resting quarters. There's a simplicity that one's paying. So that, the, how do you say, the tenor of the following of precepts is one of a commitment to simplicity and renunciation. I think we'll wrap it up for the evening. It's almost 7 o'clock.